I heartily endorse this event or product.
Ahoy, ahoy, everybody, and welcome to Talking Simpsons, a very special episode of Talking Simpsons. I am your host, as always, Bob Mackey, and who is here with me?
Henry Gilbert, Catfish.
We're recording in the other kitchen studio, and we are about to talk to the great Bill Oakley, who we talked to previously.
Yeah, but as if you guys listened to our first Bill Oakley interview, you know, there was a ton we didn't talk about, like in that we tried to kind of do an overall view of his career from starting at The Simpsons to leaving The Simpsons to working on Mission Hill and everything else. And that this time, I feel like we were a lot more relaxed.
Yeah.
We could really dig into specifics, especially because we just finished watching many of the episodes Bill Oakley wrote with Josh Weinstein during seasons 5 and 6.
Yeah, these are all new questions, by the way. And these are all the questions I just like would kick myself over after hearing the first interview. Like, oh, why didn't I ask him this? Why didn't I ask him this? But he was nice enough to come back for a second time. Hopefully he'll come back for a third time when Disenchantment comes out, and
we can
start talking about that show.
Yeah, and he was able to share a little bit with us about that, which I think was really cool. And there's a ton of there were multiple whoa, that happened?
Yeah.
Surprises.
These are things I haven't heard, and I consider myself to know everything about The Simpsons.
And especially because Oakley and Weinstein are very, very open about what they did on the commentaries, too. And this was super informative. So.
Yeah, so listen in for this great Bill Oakley interview. So for the second time, we have the great Bill Oakley joining us on Talking Simpsons. Hello, Bill.
Good morning, guys. I'm glad to be back.
Yay, we're glad to have you back.
Yeah.
So
I'm glad to be back.
Thank you. So we're now in the sixth season of The Simpsons on Talking Simpsons. And last time we talked to you, we were rolling from season 4 into season 5, a very different time compared to the beginning of season 6. What would you say are the biggest differences at your time at The Simpsons between 5 and 6 as a staff writer, not yet a showrunner?
You know, I actually don't think 5 and 6 are that different. I think that they're twin, possibly more than any other set of seasons in the early era. They might be more like twin brothers, you know? Like, I think the only thing that is really different is that everybody was a little surer of what they were doing because it was the second year of the new staff's tenure. But other than that, I honestly think that they're it's not like you're comparing, you know, season 1 and season 8. 5 and 6 are kind of like twins, in my opinion.
I remember you saying on commentaries that the second year of a showrunner is basically the hardest year. They have less time, less control. Did you experience that with David Merkin? And did you find yourself being given more control as you were moving into the role of showrunner with Josh?
We were not moving into the role of showrunner yet.
Okay.
That wasn't even decided until late in the sixth season, and it was a long and arduous process to making our deal, and we were not transitioning into the showrunner role at all in that time. We were still working as, you know, as employees. However, I think that one thing that happened was that David Merkin decided that we were better off just writing scripts. So I think we wrote 5 episodes that year, and we pretty much stayed in our office the whole year just writing these episodes and turning them in, and they didn't get rewritten that much. And I think it was, you know, there was more harmony on the staff than there had been in the fifth season, because there was kind of a sea change in the fifth season when David Merkin came on board. But everybody sort of found a way to work together by season 6.
I had a theory when we did the episode for Sweet Seymour Skinner's Badass Song that one, you know, watching it now feels so much, it almost feels like a transplanted episode from 7 and 8. Like,
it does.
More so than any, I'd say more so than any 5 and 6 episode dub that you and Josh wrote. I think it has the feel of an episode you show ran. Did you guys have any more involvement in it than any of your other ones? Or am I just making grand assumptions here?
I wouldn't say that. Like, I think we had an equal let me get my thoughts together. I think we had an equal amount of involvement in that as to all our ones. I mean, that was the blessing of working in that era, was that we had, I guess we were the most senior writers on the show, even though we'd only been there for 18 months. And I think we were given a certain amount of leeway to do the episodes the way we wanted to do them, although definitely David Merkin would lead the rewrites of them. They would not, the rewrites would usually not be extensive. And sometimes, you know, and we had a greater, I think, greater input on like the storyboards and the direction than the average person at that time. In any case, the reason that you're probably feeling that is that it was, that episode was really dry and heartfelt. Like the first two acts of it were real sincere, which is something that was not really happening all that much in season five, as I recall. And they were really sincere. And also they were really carefully observed and not really that jokey. Like that whole thing with the freaking laundry detergent with Skinner just sitting there listening to that, like that was not, there's no real joke in there. I mean, it's just kind of a slow observational slice of life that's funny in context. But like, I think those are the kind of things that we definitely packed into season 7 and 8. So maybe that's what you're sensing.
Yeah, the original ending is on the DVD and it does feel like a season 5 ending, which Homer crashes through a wall as part of his, I guess, plan to get Flanders fired, not knowing he had been fired. But the way it ends, it feels very much like the seasons you and Josh ran. It's like a little heartfelt, a little bit of bittersweetness behind it.
Well, I will tell you, that is not the original ending in any way, shape, or form.
Oh, really? It was on the actual, animatic.
The original ending. Well, the original ending was in the script. Like, it changed. The third act of that show changed radically because it was too long, basically. That, and I think I tweeted this like 2 years ago. I tweeted the original outline for the episode, and the original outline had was much more complicated, and it would have been like a 1 hour episode. And basically what happened was that there was a much more in-depth B story, which was that Flanders became principal and Homer transitioned into the head of the PTA, which had been Flanders's role prior to that. And all that Homer wanted to do was get Flanders fired. So there was kind of like a war between the PTA and the principal, and it just made Flanders's life miserable. And Homer was being kind of a jerk about it. And there was a lot of really, really, really funny stuff. But anyway, even as a script, it was way, way, way too long. Mm. And so that third act changed a lot. Like, to be honest, I know people really love that ending with like Chalmers going prayer in a school, blah, blah, blah. But like, I never really liked it that much because I preferred the kind of more earned ending that we originally had in the outline and script. Anyway, but it was just like, we shouldn't have written a script that was 60 pages long if we wanted to have our ending in it.
That does explain why Homer is not really in that episode a whole lot.
Oh, yeah. He had a huge subplot in the thing. And anyway, perhaps as a adjunct to this podcast, when you release it, I can retweet the original outline for anybody who really wants to get into the weeds on this issue.
Oh, I really do, too.
Yeah, well, as long as you're talking about that episode too, I think one of the most celebrated jokes from that episode I've seen in like memedom is Billy and the Clonosaurus. was that you guys, or did that come in the rewrite?
I'm pretty sure that was us. In fact, it might even be in the outline. When I dig it up, we will see. But yes, that one I'm pretty sure was in the original script.
I love that joke so much of hearing somebody, everybody's been in that situation of hearing somebody say like, oh, I have this great idea for something, and you want to tell them how bad it is, but manners tell you not to, and then Apu just unloads on Skinner.
Yeah, well, that's like, you know, a lot of that episode was really painfully realistic, at least in our minds, about Skinner's life. Like, both Josh and I had gone to the same high school, and a lot of our teachers really made like Principal Skinner look like a like Hugh Hefner. Like, they were like, they like, whatever life, private life you think Skinner had, the teachers who taught us and during our formative years, I think, had kind of even weirder private lives and that were in some ways more lonely. Aww. So a lot of the stuff that we like, him in his bedroom upstairs conducting music along with his reel-to-reel tape recorder, man, I think that really happened. And I think all that other stuff was like, was just drawn from reality, like a person who gets fired and then is like, I'm going to write the great American novel. That was a real trope of things in like the 50s and 60s. Oh, yeah. Of people like having the great American novel in their head. And in this case, it was so Skinnery that it had already, you know, he was completely unaware that it had already been done.
So a recurring theme in virtually all of your season 5 and season 6 episodes you wrote with Josh is grandpa complaining. And we wanted to know, what defines the perfect grandpa rant?
Well, a lot of historical inaccuracies, for one. Like, we didn't, you know, to be honest, we were only walking in the footsteps of giants on that one, because there's really no more famous rant than that one about the onion, wearing an onion on your belt from the last exit of Springfield, you know? And like, that kind of set the temp, unless I'm recalling wrong, that was probably the first such. There were lots of other ones where he was writing letters to the editor,
right,
and you get General Crab, but in terms of going off on a long story, in fact, that one actually sets up the thing. We used to tell them long stories that would bore them the tears or whatever. Like, I think that was where the whole idea of those long rants were invented. So to be honest, it was a formula established in that episode that we were merely copying, which is a lot, which is a lot of reminiscing, historical inaccuracies, things, contradictions, ideally within that, within the same paragraph, and stuff like that. You know, that's, I think, what the elements of the grandpa.
Interesting.
Rant.
Yeah. As part of the show, we do a lot of research to find out what every joke means, what every reference is. And digging into the grandpa speeches is great because I found out what a galvanic belt is, a curative galvanic belt.
I thought we made that up, but you know what? Josh would know. That's his kind of territory.
Yeah.
So perhaps it was a real thing.
I guess it was supposed to lightly shock you throughout the day to give you energy. So that's no longer on the market anymore.
Are you guys a little jealous of writers today who have, you know, Google and Wikipedia and they don't have to like pull out reference books everywhere to find all the grandpa-isms?
You know, I wonder whether people like grandpa-isms anymore, to be honest. Mm. Like, think about it now, grandpa is referencing stuff that's like 140 years old. And I'm wondering if it was already kind of like on the verge of its expiration date in the 1990s. Like, that's, I guess that's a question for you guys who are much younger than me. Like, if you saw that stuff today, what would you, I mean, it's, we had I had a grandfather who was born in 1890. So all that kind of stuff, I was familiar with the idea of a grandfather who would talk about stuff that would involve, that was crazy and old time. But these days, people's grandfathers were born in like 1950, right?
Yeah.
So like, I'm wondering if we're past the expiration date on that sort of curative galvanic belt stuff.
It would feel wrong to me if Grandpa Simpson referenced anything after maybe 1940, but he's also too old to be alive if you follow the continuity of the show.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
you guys would really, well, actually, in your seasons, you guys put more numbers on people than before. Like, you set up Homer's age as, I believe, 38, and same with Mr. Burns is 104. Like,
good eye for detail there.
And so that's
exactly right.
Yeah. And that kind of places them at specific times. Same with like, it's a recurring joke on the show I do for continuity's sake of just saying like, oh, Burns and Abe are hanging out together, but don't they remember they were in World War II together? Like, are they thinking about the Tontine this entire time? Like,
well, I don't think anybody had any idea that this show would be going on for so long that this would become an issue.
It's part of the fun.
We're down to our last World War II vets, I'm pretty sure, at this point in history.
Oh, definitely. I mean, yeah. I mean, it just, Burns is referencing those baseball players from 1857 or whenever they were. It's like he would be 170 years old. It's like even back then it was absurd, but now I'm wondering like how it just seems like somebody is talking about being in a Revolutionary War or something, you know.
So I want to talk about some specific episodes, and one of which there's a bit of controversy around. Well, there used to be. It's A Star Is Burns, the famous critic crossover. I think everyone remembers that as a very enjoyable episode with Jay Sherman involved, but there was some behind the scenes dust ups. Can you talk a little bit about that and where you fell in that argument about whether or not there should be a critic crossover?
You know, did you guys read the article that was in the LA Times about this topic? Like, I think that covers it pretty well.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. How long ago was that?
Well, it was whenever that thing came on the air. I think
Okay,
at the time. Yeah, I think I have read it at one point in time.
Yeah, I read it as well. James L. Brooks had some words about Matt Groening taking his name off it and all that. So, that covers it pretty well in the time.
But yeah. I mean, I would say that we were probably on Matt's side. Like, here's the thing. It was a thorny issue because, number one, Mike and Al had hired us. Mike and Al, we have an immense amount of respect for Mike and Al and their terrific work they did on the entire time they were there, including the best season of TV ever, which is season 3 of The Simpsons. And they went off to create The Critic, which also on its own is hilarious. You know, I think it was a question of a lot of people back then, including us and maybe Matt, had kind of high-minded ideas about The Simpsons as being a unique thing that should be free from things like promoting other TV shows. And there had been a number of attempts within that universe, like celebrities calling up and trying to get on to promote their thing. Like, I'll just go back and say, this is not necessarily a parallel issue, but for a while there was a entire subplot in a gambling episode about a Planet Hollywood opening up in Springfield. I don't know if this was covered on the DVDs or what.
I think it was mentioned lightly, but yeah.
But it was like, publicist for Planet Hollywood called up and was like, we'll get you the voices of Schwarzenegger and Bruce Willis and whoever the hell was the third guy in that restaurant scam. They'll be on the show if you make a whole subplot about Planet Hollywood. And so we had to do it. And I think that we were like, this crummy, you know, The Simpsons from long before the time we were hired, we thought The Simpsons was the best show in the history of TV, bar none, and that we should, and it should be devoid of things like promotion for a theme restaurant or promoting. Now, in the case of The Critic, it was a much thornier issue because it was Mike and Al's show. They were Simpsons heroes. They'd hired all of us. And it was also Brooks's show. And Brooks is the man who writes the checks and runs the whole operation. So, you know, he wanted to do it. And I would say the writers in general did not want to do it. But the episode came out. Like, here's the thing. Ultimately, the episode came out very well. And nobody cared about the cross promotion except for us writers. And I think we were proven wrong a number of times during that era about like us thinking The Simpsons was so that it was, we shouldn't tamper with the formula because they tampered with the formula and it worked fine and nobody cared. So that was the thing. And I think we were probably a little too strident in our opinions as we were back then. And remain today. Maybe our trademark is being strident in our opinions, but there was a controversy. Yes.
You know, as a fan, I totally understand that. As a fan, like, I wouldn't have liked if, say, Drexler from Drexler's Class showed up on The Simpsons to promote his show, or if it was another one. But even at the time, I knew I loved The Critic as a fan and was aware of its connection to The Simpsons. So it did feel more organic. And also, I thought the joke about the Flintstones meeting the Jetson in there kind of undercut it so much that it was like, okay, they recognize.
That's great.
Yeah, I would say that ultimately we were probably on the wrong side of that thing, and it shouldn't have been the big deal. And I mean, it wasn't like we were being consulted about it. It was just that we were on the writing staff and we had an opinion. Like, ultimately, it was. And also, I should say it wasn't just one. There were supposed to be four episodes, as I recall, where The Critic appeared.
Oh wow, I didn't know this.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was the case, and then that was talked down to one. So, you know, it was a bigger thing than it was presented. But anyway, I think that we were on the wrong side and it came out fine.
Well, speaking of specific episodes, we just recorded the one for Sideshow Bob Roberts.
Oh, yeah.
And that is one of my all-time favorites. Watching it now, I was shocked at how openly political and with an opinion it was, which you don't really see on network TV sitcoms these days, I would say. And so, I mean, was that ever an issue getting into like say, which I agree with, that Republicans are vampires and monsters?
Yeah, it's much harder on Republicans than Democrats, which I like, but it was surprising to see that in that era.
I think politically, The Simpsons has already up to that point had been pretty balanced in terms of like criticizing both sides equally. And there were a large number of jokes about Democrats. I thought, what, didn't you wonder why you were getting checks for doing absolutely nothing, Grandpa? Yeah. I thought it was because the Democrats were in power again.
Yeah.
There were a number of jokes like that. And like in this case, it was just like the episode, at least the political parts of it, almost practically wrote themselves. Like, it was so, this was the, you know, the height of Rush Limbaugh mania. And also, this episode is so anti, I have to say, seeing this episode now, the politics are so quaint. Like, it's so like, even Bob's conspiracy, like, first of all, Bob is a very talented guy who was very smart and probably would have been a perfectly fine mayor, even if he was evil, as opposed to like what we have now. I don't want to get into politics. I got criticisms last time for getting into politics on your show. So maybe I'll just steer clear. Anyway, I'll steer clear of it. But the thing is that Matt, like, the show is to some extent the voice or is the voice of Matt Groening. And Matt Groening is well known to have, you know, left-wing political views. And that's like why we did that whole joke about him being the right-wing cartoonist with the eye patch who created Johnny Reb and Tales of Damnation, you know, and that NRA for Everything and that clip show thing. So I would just say the whole point was to embrace, to criticize the Republicans with such, to have it be over the top. I mean, it was supposed to be silly. Like, the majority of the criticisms of Republicans were supposed to be so over the top that they couldn't be taken seriously, that they were like, they were vampires. You know, it was ham-handed intentionally, like they were vampires who lived in a castle and stuff. And the Democrats were portrayed as bumbling and, you know, fairly, Quimby is already a well-established character, so we didn't have to go too far from canon to work with that, you know.
I did like that literally was growing pot in the mayor's office. Like, that was pretty great.
Yeah. And he was farming it himself too, which I thought was pretty ambitious.
He was very hands on. Yeah. And also in that episode, I think Smithers's sexuality had been danced around for a while, but this felt even more so of Smithers outright saying agree with his choice of lifestyle.
Yeah, it did feel like the first time Smithers' gayness was not a joke. It was a plot point, but also a way to characterize him.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I guess I'd say I feel like it had already been fairly well established over the years, you know, like with the Mr. Burns flying into his window and during that fantasy sequence and stuff. And in this case, it's true that this was the first time it had been taken seriously and it wasn't played as a joke. And it just seemed like it was the whole thing was in a retelling of the Watergate scandal. And he seemed like the perfect person to kind of play Deep Throat in that he was like, you know, he was in on the inner workings of that scheme. Anyway, yes, I think you're right in saying that was probably the first time it was handled with seriousness.
Yeah, I also love in that scene where when Homer reveals Deep Throat is Smithers and he just says, "Hi, Mr. Smithers," like that reminds me of the friendliness in their relationship in Homer the Smithers too, which is one of my favorites of the seasons you guys ran.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, it's businesslike but friendly their relationship. And I would say Homer probably thinks that Smithers likes him a lot more than he does, but that's part of Homer's charm.
So I wanted to get into the basically the path to becoming a showrunner for season 7 and 8. On our last interview, I believe you said you probably would have left the show if you had not become a showrunner with Josh for those seasons. And from our conversation now, it sounds like a very long and tedious process. Can you talk a little bit about the steps that were taken to get there and how you eventually landed in that role with Josh?
Yeah, I'm trying to think back on some of the origins of it. Like, I actually don't remember why Merkin wanted to, like, I think the thing is, up till that point, it seemed like everybody took the job for 2 years and then they left. And like, that's kind of what Sam had done. And that's what Mike Cannell had done. And then David Merkin did that too. Although I wonder if he had the opportunity to stay on, and I'm surprised it didn't, but he had a feature movie career that was taking off and maybe he wanted to get out of Dodge at that point. So I guess, yeah, thinking back on it, I'm actually wondering why he didn't stay for a third or fourth season, but perhaps, I don't know. He probably answered that better. Anyway, so the job was going to be vacant. And I mean, Josh and I think, we're certainly the most senior guys there, and we had written more scripts than anybody at that point on the staff, other than Swartzwelder, who was not really like he didn't really come in at that point. He just kind of brought his scripts in and left. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of visions for the show, and I think I believe I wasn't privy to all the back behind the scenes stuff, but I know that Merkin recommended us for the job, and I'm eternally grateful to him for doing that, and that he lobbied for us. And I know the biggest issue was that we didn't want to take the job for 2 years. We wanted to take it for 1 year.
Oh, really?
And yeah. And it remained like the contract stalled out for like, I don't know, 5 or 6 months. I recall like they were just like, no, you're not going to do that for 1 year. And we said, okay, well, we're not doing it then. And then they came back. And then like 5 months later, they came back and said, okay, I don't know what happened during that period. I assume they searched around or they sought out substitutes for us, but then they came back and said, okay, you can do it for 1 year. And then halfway through the next year, we were like, okay, we'll do it for one more year. And I would say it was easier for us too, also because there are two of us, as opposed to someone like David Merkin, who had to handle everything on his own. Since Josh and I were able to divide up the work, it wasn't quite as backbreaking as it had been, you know, for a single guy running the show.
I wondered too if, you know, one of your last episodes before you guys took over was the Simpsons only two-parter ever, Who Shot Mr. Burns? And were you guys more involved in that one than other episodes you did show ran? And I had always wondered if that helped with your transition over to show running.
I think we were writing, this is an interesting point, I don't remember the timing of it. I think that we were already in the middle of writing that episode when those contract negotiations were going on. And in fact, I'm pretty sure I recall like writing, we were in the middle of writing part two and we were like, okay, well, this is it. We turned in this script, we're walking out the door and leaving. And I think that was the point when the contract negotiations had fallen apart. And we were just like, okay, well, let's get this wrapped up. Let's do a great job and then clean out our office and leave. And were we more involved in that? I mean, not really. Dave Merkin was the showrunner. And we definitely, just because of the large number of clues and other stuff that had to be inserted, we were kind of like, we really went over the storyboards with, you know, with a fine tooth comb and did that kind of stuff. But just to make sure that the proper clues were laid in. In terms of everything else, like directing the actors and doing all the general producing, that was still David Merkin 100%.
This came up in our research for Lady Bouvier's Lover, that there was an article in 1994 for in the LA Daily News about the table read for it that really focused, you know, on Merkin and the actors. But I was curious, first off, you know, but did you recall that day when the reporter was there? And do you recall this article?
No. To answer your question bluntly, I did read the article because you sent it to me. I recall the table read with great vividness because it was probably one of the best table reads we ever had.
Oh, wow.
At least when we were there, because the story really pulled at your heartstrings. And like, that was one of the things that, like, the table read is a weird beast because it's the composition of people sitting in that room is not really that similar to the composition of the Simpsons audience. You know, it's like the Simpsons audience in my mind is always kind of like mainly males between the ages of like, you know, 15 and 25. Although I'm sure it's definitely not that way anymore. That's what it was back then. Like, and the people in the table read are often grownups. And like grown-ups didn't really watch The Simpsons. I have to say, like, that's why we were still number 55 in the ratings every week, because like all the grownups were too busy watching Mad About You, which, you know, we all know how that turned out. Anyway, so that table read was excellent because it appealed to the older crowd that was in the table reads. And it was emotional. It was an emotional story with very clear plot points. And Josh and I have always learned that over the years that like a story with really clear emotional plot points will always play much better at the table read, no matter what it is, than an abstract show. Like, for instance, like 22 Short Films, which had a terrible table read. And the table read, as I said, is a weird beast because you're playing it for an audience that is not the real audience. And a lot of it just depends on what the actors are doing at the table. And even back then, a lot of times the actors would not all be there. And my guess is that because this was being reported by the newspaper, all the actors showed up that day.
Oh, wow.
So, like, we didn't have to have a telephone with Harry Shearer broadcasting over it from London. Like, they all probably came in and sat down that day because it was being reported upon. So that was maybe one of the reasons it was such a great table read.
Yeah, and there's one bit in there that really got me, that it said that Maggie spoke her second word in that script, that she had said spaghetti. Like, do you remember that? Because that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah. Wasn't that in the episode?
No.
It wasn't? Man, no. I still feel like that wasn't the episode. It must have gotten cut for time in the last, because you're...
It's not even a deleted scene on DVD.
Yeah, it's not on the DVDs as a deleted scene either, no.
That's hilarious, because I could have sworn, if you had bet me, I would have bet you $50 right now that it was, was actually on the air. But yeah, it must have got cut for time, because the whole joke was, she spoke a second word and nobody cared.
Oh, okay.
It was during that birthday party thing. And she just said spaghetti, and she kept saying it over and over and over. And everybody was like, you said your first word last week. We don't care anymore. And you can talk. And I think also maybe Matt may have had some objection to it, because he didn't want the character to evolve past, you know, to have the ability to talk. And that might have been why it got cut, too.
Interesting.
Wow, man.
So I was going over just, you know, scanning the season 6 episodes in preparation for our upcoming recordings. And I noticed that season 6 is the first time that there was a woman staff writer on the show, Jennifer Crittenden. And she's actually written some of my favorite shows. Scenes from the Class Struggle in Springfield is one of my all-time favorites. Can you talk about how having a woman on the staff changed things, or maybe didn't change things? I'm just curious as to what Jennifer's additions were to the show.
You know, I think you should, I guess, have her on and ask her.
Oh,
you know, I don't know.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah,
that the scripts that she turned in were quite good, especially the Country Club script, which I always really liked. I believe that it was. You know, I can't answer these questions. You have to ask her. Like, I think it was a weird situation because the place. I'll just come if I say this. It was definitely a boys' club. There was no question about it, especially back then. And I think it was probably difficult to be the only woman there. And, you know, in retrospect, I think we should have probably had more women on the staff and whatnot. But, you know, I can't really answer those questions. I think you'd have to ask her.
Oh, we'd love to.
I do know that there were some difficult times. And then she ended up leaving the show. And, you know, in the middle of whatever season 7, I guess. Or anyway, so it was a strange situation. It was difficult. It wasn't like... I didn't think it was difficult, but obviously I'm not a young woman in a group of 30-year-old guys who've all known each other for 20 years. You know, that was the thing about the show, is really like, not only was it a boys club, but many of us had known each other since freshman year of college. Mm-hmm. So it was a weird situation for anybody to come into. let alone, you know, a younger woman.
Well, speaking of the writer's room, this came up multiple times on the commentaries, and that there was even a direct joke about it in with Homer with the waffle on the ceiling. What's the deal with the caramel in the writer's room that was on the ceiling? Like, what do you remember about that?
You know, I think that was, this is not going to be a satisfying answer. Oh. It was before my time. It was on the ceiling.
They removed it.
It was on the ceiling when we were there.
Okay.
But I didn't get to see it stuck to the, there was a lot of, that writer's room was at least the season four writer's room, which was also the writer's room from day one, was a huge mess. It was a huge garbage hole. And there were tons of garbage. There was just like, it had old furniture that had clearly been put in there in the early 70s, which had been beat up. It was exactly like the basement of some fraternity house where people had gotten furniture in the early 70s and had not cleaned it or replaced it or even cleaned up the room for many years. And there was a lot of crud, like promotional food was always being sent because like Butterfinger BBs. We were promoting Butterfinger a lot. You may recall Simpsons for the spokesman for Butterfingers. So there'd always be a lot of Butterfingers, but that doesn't explain the caramel. I'm sorry to say the caramel, my guess is it was probably Conan, given his other famous messes he made in the room, who probably stuck the caramel to the ceiling. It was there, but I never heard exactly how it got stuck there. Sorry, I can't tell you.
Oh, it's okay. I mean, was there ever a feeling of like, we can't clean this off or it's just part of the room now?
Not about the caramel. About other elements, perhaps, yes. But the caramel, I think, was removed. We finally cleaned that room up when we took over in season, because we moved everybody back there. Seasons five and six, the room was basically in Merkin's office, which was a huge room across the parking lot. When we took over, we moved the room back to the old room, the season one through four room, and we had it cleaned out. And I guess the caramel probably got cleaned off in that in that cleanup. And no, it was not a legendary piece of
it should be in a museum
of memorabilia. Yeah, it wasn't. You know what? It didn't live up to the hype. It wasn't even that big. Sorry.
Oh, come on. Okay,
you're ruining all our imaginations here.
Well, I wanted to jump to another episode we just did a show about. It's another Simpsons clip show, and you could tell it was made against people's will, and we're not bitter about
clear
that.
Clear on the commentary.
Yes. How could you tell that? Well, also because of the names of the writer and director.
I mean, if it makes you feel better, having been on the staff at that time, nobody remembers that clip show from my polling on Twitter. No one remembers that it exists. But I just was curious, did working on that clip show or having that clip show exist in your run, did that change how you approached the clip show that you were forced to do?
Yes. However, we didn't have to work on that clip show. I mean, the reason that this all happened was that Fox said, we want 24 episodes. And the show said, we can only produce 22. I mean, it was hard enough to produce 22 without everybody, you know, working themselves to death. And Fox was like, we want 24. So like, I guess in one season, it was a clip show and it was the critic show, right? Mm-hmm. And then in season seven, it was the X-Files show and the bowling show, right? The Merkin did one and mm-hmm. Mike Canale did the other. So like every year after season five, I think there were two extra shows done by an outside party because like the policy, and I think Merkin started this, was like, we are not doing those extra shows. You have to find someone else to do them. So for the clip show, I think that, you know, the script was written. The script was only like six pages, and the script and the rest of it was clips. And I don't know who put it together. I mean, it might have been Merkin, but I think that it might have been a guy who worked for Fox Promotions. Mm. Like,
wow.
And that was the same thing that happened with the one that we did too. Like the one that we did with Fox Promotions as well. It was not done by the regular thing. We did the room. VD wrote that script for our clip show, which was the 138th. Yes, we decided we're going to do a clip show, but it was going to have a little bit more zing than the previous ones. It was not going to be just phoned in, you know, just to fulfill the contractual order. We wanted to have a little bit more pizzazz in ours. So we did, VD wrote the script, and we rewrote it in like a day or two in the room. And then we picked the clips mainly, and I directed Phil doing the narration of it, but it was like, it was still put together by the Fox Promotions Department, like using their like whole, their editing and their kind of producing facilities and stuff.
Interesting.
Like it wasn't even done in our usual path of production, you know?
Yeah. I noticed that even the animation is different. It's digital, just like Radioactive Man.
Yeah. They were very limited in what they could do because it was also a Film Roman issue. And like Silverman, I think directed that, but like, he was like, I can only make whatever, a minute and a half of new animation and that's it. and it can barely have any movement, which is why it's like Troy McClure walking around on that stage.
I recall on the commentary too, you said that the director was a little, he wasn't the biggest fan of you guys talking about the crude animation in the original episode, or the Tracy Ullman shorts.
He did. He got me. David Silverman should have known, and hope he knows, that we consider him to be among the most talented people on Earth. But he didn't like that joke about the fact that all the stuff was so crudely drawn. And yeah, he had a little bit of burst. He had a big burst of emotion about that. And we were like, we're sorry, it's just a joke, you know, because they were making fun of the, you know, the art and the Tracy Ullman, which he had done a lot of. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but
well, yeah, I mean,
got over it.
Well, and I mean, yeah, it was one of the first things they ever drew, and they were doing it had never been done before, so I don't blame any crudeness on it. What was the situation to like get Tracy Ullman shorts on the show? Because those aren't really even on the DVDs or anything. It always seemed to me there's might be some weird licensing issues with that or something.
You know what? It's quite possible there are, but like at that time there was no problem whatsoever, because I mean Tracy Ullman's show was Brooks's show. It was also done by 20th, I think. And like, I don't know, it never cropped up. Now, like the reason that the old shorts might not be out is because Tracy Ullman may have some sort of control over them. Mm. I have no idea. I know there was a lawsuit about that, you know,
right.
Tracy Ullman sued for some percentage of Simpsons because she claimed it had been created under her watch. I don't know the details of that. That was before my time, but we didn't have any problem licensing the stuff for that.
Yeah, it is a real shame you can't really see those in good quality, because I mean they're online, but they are also you know, recorded off of Lifetime 20 years ago, and I just feel like it's such an important part of Simpsons history. People should see them as they aired, like with, you know, good quality.
That's a good point. I didn't know that they were not available in some form. Huh.
No, yeah, I mean, you can find like taped off VHS things from it, because like the Tracy Ullman show hasn't really, I don't know if it's airing on TV now, if you can find it on like a cable channel, but some of the ones I've seen were either taped off Lifetime or taped off Comedy Central Anytime. The Tracy Ullman show was syndicated. So I think it's a real gift of the 138th. Spectacular that it has those in there, and and same with two showing those deleted scenes. Like that was a lot of stuff that those were new to us as viewers.
Yeah, I always thought that stuff was cool. You know, that was the whole genesis of that was that the editor of our show, Mark McChimney, had a collection. He had started a collection in his editing bay of deleted scenes. This was before the DVDs even existed, right? And so we were like, oh my, like just as Simpsons fans, when we found out about that, we were like, oh my God, this is amazing. Let's just make this part of the clip show. And there wasn't enough to fill up a whole clip show. But we were like, that was the genesis of the whole thing, was like, let's show these deleted scenes, because there's no other way that people could have ever seen them. You know what he also had back there, but down there, which we saw, was the very first episode that was all messed up.
You may
have heard and read about in the Simpsons book about how the first episode came back and it was a huge mess. And that, you know, it basically, that's why it started, the series started with the Christmas episode instead of what was supposed to be the first episode. And yeah, we saw it. You know what? It wasn't really that much of a mess. I didn't think it was, but it was an interesting window into that time as to, like, you know, what changed about the show and what didn't.
Maybe that should not be released on DVD then, that part of the show. So you and Josh had a lot of interesting guests during your time, a lot of atypical guests, a lot of old men. And I'm just wondering, were there anyone you wanted on the show that you couldn't get, or either didn't get The Simpsons, didn't like The Simpsons, they were busy? I'm just curious as to what shook out there.
Yes, is the answer to your question. And it was you're never going to believe the freaking answer. It was Stockard Channing.
Wow.
Do you guys even know who Stockard Channing is?
I have vague, vague memories.
I'll tell you, like, this is the weirdest, like, there was a certain type of person that you could easily get on The Simpsons, which is either like an old guy who didn't get much work anymore, like Lawrence Tierney, or somebody with kids. And as I'm telling you, and it's just impossible for people to understand this, grown-ups were not watching The Simpsons very much back in those days. And so, like, they'd heard of it, and they were like, they were sometimes, you know, outraged by the t-shirts and crap like that. But like, it was their kids. It was invariably someone's kids who forced them to do it. And that's like how we got Meryl Streep, or how Dave Merkin got Meryl Streep and a number of those other big time actresses that he had in season five, because their kids wanted them to do it. And it's like, oh, my kids couldn't possibly have urged. It was the most, you know, Meryl Streep was like saying, that's my kids. That's my favorite thing. I have earned my kids' respect having been invited on The Simpsons. That was the typical kind of thing that people would say. But there was a certain category of actress that we could never get, which was kind of an older actress who didn't, to my knowledge, have kids, like Faye Dunaway. Like, I don't know if Faye Dunaway have kids. I have no idea. But if she did, she was not – if she had kids, they were not Simpsons fans, or they were fully grown. Because Faye Dunaway was one person that we wanted to have on the show that Dave Merkin tried to get in season five or six. And she was like – not only would she not do it, but she sent back like a real insulting reply.
Oh, wow.
And we were like, that's why we have that joke, and that's why Honk If You're Horny is starring Pauly Shore and Faye Dunaway.
Oh, nice revenge.
And then the other person was in that Country Club episode that we just discussed, written by Jennifer Crittenden. The woman, the main Country Club lady, who's Marge's old friend, was supposed to be a celebrity. And we went through about a million, like, 60-year-old lady actresses. Soccer Channing being the most famous one, but we went back to her a couple times that we just couldn't get any. We couldn't get any of them. So we just were like, okay, fine. We'll give it to Tress then.
Well, she did a great job.
She did.
Oh, no. Tress is terrific. And like, really, like, she should have been cast from day one. But I think we also had that same issue with Belle, who was running the burlesque house, which is also why Tress did that. And Tress was great. And she should have, she should have more starring roles as her own. But usually those kind of roles you offer to a celebrity, just like, as I think I said before, like Steve Martin was the person we asked to be Frank Grimes, but we couldn't get him or whatever. So then Hank did it and he's become a legend or he's made Frank Grimes into a legend. So that kind of thing often works out for the best.
You know, you mentioned Lawrence Tierney. I wasn't going to ask about this. You definitely hint to him being a problem as in the recording. Listeners, he played Don Brodka. And to my generation, he's most famous as the big mean boss in Reservoir Dogs. And I had also seen an interview with, I'm blanking on her name now, but the casting director on the show saying that when he came to this, to record, that she recalled him being a bit of a problem on a previous film she'd worked on with him. So, are there any extra details you could add about working with, the Lawrence Tierney?
Well, I would say that if you have the DVDs, I think it's all covered on the commentary for that episode, but I'll review quickly. Mm-hmm. Lawrence Tierney was regarded as a known problem since 1940 when he started out. Like, he was beating up people on the set of his movies in the 1940s. Then he disappeared for a long time, and then he had this renaissance based on Reservoir Dogs. And you may know that he was Elaine's father on Seinfeld.
That's right.
In one of the first couple episodes, and then he was banned from the show after stealing a knife. He stole like a kitchen knife and threatened Jerry with it as like a joke or something, and that was like, and then he was never asked back. I don't think we knew that at the time, because Josh and I were like, what we really wanted was distinctive voices for the show, and like, that's why we got people like, you know, Kirk Douglas and Johnny Cash and people of that nature. And Lawrence Tierney has an extremely distinctive voice, so we were like, yeah, we got him. It was no problem. Then the short version of the story is we sent a limo to pick him up. The limo drops him off and is supposed to wait for him to finish, take him home. And the limo driver says, there's no way I'm taking that man home. And Ben zooms off, leaving him there. And that was the beginning of it. And then like he, you know, immediately walked down the stairs into the recording studio, kind of first of all pinned the casting director against the wall and was like, hey, baby.
Oh, boy.
Then we were like, come on right down here, Mr. Tierney. And then he was just like, you know, he did a pretty, pretty good job. But he was like, he was real cantankerous. I mean, he got really mad at some dude who was eating a sandwich. And he's like, we're trying to rehearse over here. And so we were like, and it was Josh and me who were both like, we were just like, we didn't know how to handle him. So we were just like, okay, well, let's do take one here. And and then he did. And then he was like, I was thinking about doing this in a Southern accent. And we were like, no. And so we let him try it. We let him try it for a take or two. And then we're just like, let's do it in your regular voice. And then like, he didn't get any of the jokes, but as long as we got him to read them, we kind of were able to piece them together in editing. And Josh, who was doing most of the directing, did a great job handling him. And then I think it was all done in about 20 minutes. But like, just say in the 20 minutes, he had about 12 real hostile interactions with the people on the staff and the people surrounding the thing. But, and then we're like, okay, thank you. And then he left. And obviously a new limo had to come pick him up and take him away.
Wow. That, I didn't know that all happened in such a short amount of time. I'd heard those stories before. I imagined it as like a whole day he was there, but in under an hour, that was
No, we rushed through that because we were like, as soon as we got one usable take of him reading a line, we were like, okay, next line. And we got him out fast.
I read in Nancy's book she wrote a while back, Kirk Douglas was also a little cantankerous, not as much as Lawrence Tierney, of course. Can you talk about directing him?
Yeah. I wouldn't say he was cantankerous as much as, you know, he was like, I'm only giving you one take, that's all you need. And we were like, okay. Because he's Kirk Douglas, you know, that wasn't like, he wasn't like, let's just say Kirk Douglas was incredibly professional. Mm-hmm. But he didn't want to screw around. He was like, because I remember he was in the booth with Nancy and I was directing him. And I was like, we usually did four takes just as a matter of course. And I think we did two. And then he was like, I don't want to do any more. And he said to Nancy, you give him too many. He said to Nancy, like, give him too much to choose from. They don't know what to do or whatever. And it's true that like every single take he did identically. So there was no point in wasting his time. And he was obviously a man who had enough experience to know how to perform the lines.
I would just be intimidated thinking like this guy's been directed by Stanley Kubrick. What am I doing?
It's true.
You know, I didn't really know that much about Kirk Douglas. And I will tell you, he wasn't the first choice for that role either. Mm. We really wanted William Hickey, who has now been dead for 20 years. But you may recall him from like Married to the Mob and other like Jonathan Demme movies.
He's got an amazing voice.
Yeah. And I think he was too sick or something to do it. But like we had our hearts set. This is, I know it's ironic because Kirk Douglas is an Oscar winning actor, but Josh and I had our hearts set on William Hickey for this role. Mm. And so when we got Kirk Douglas, we were like, okay, well, I guess we'll go for Kirk Douglas.
Oh, you poor guys. So since our last conversation, I've noticed on Twitter you have really embraced the world of Simpsons shitposting. And for all of our listeners out there, that is basically just sort of memeifying, you know, jokes in The Simpsons, giving them different punchlines, plugging in different characters. One of my favorites I've seen that's been really simple, it is the joke from Marge Be Not Proud where Bart puts the Hello Mudda, Hello Father song in the answering machine, except in the video, the entire song plays while Homer just sits there blinking. And then the joke is Lisa Camp Granada? That's my favorite. I just wanted you to talk about some of your favorite from the world of Simpsons shitposting.
Okay, my favorite, bar none, is the thing with Homer's slow spreading smile at the dud, you know, and like that, like you may recall, just for the uninitiated, I will just point back to the episode Summer of 4'2", when they were playing Mystery Date on the back porch. Homer and Marge are playing with Bart and Milhouse, and Bart gets the dud, and Marge goes, "You got the dud, ha!" And Homer has a slow, as Homer suddenly realizes what's going on, he gets his smile slowly spreads across his face, and then he bursts out and says, "Hey, he looks just like you, Poindexter," to Milhouse. And so that piece of animation, like, is always fast. The weird thing is because it's so much, this particular meme is so aligned with my personal interests. Like, that slow spreading smile has always amused the crap out of me. It's like, because it's such a subtle piece of acting, and it's funny to see Homer suddenly get happy, like, as you see the wheels in his head turning. Yeah. So this particular type of shit post is a thing where somebody, where the smile, it's a two-part thing. The dud is revealed, and then Homer smiles. However, the nature of the shitpost is the dud is revealed in a different context, and the smile is pasted onto someone else's head. And there's a video of it, like, that must be 7 minutes of just nonstop remixes of this particular thing in other Simpsons scenes. Like, for instance, when Hank Scorpio is in his lair and that giant panel opens up that would normally reveal the UN, there's a picture of the dud, and then you cut to Hank Scorpio's face, and there's the smile is pasted onto his face, a slowly spreading smile. And it just goes, there's almost any scene in The Simpsons where a door is opened or something is revealed, they've pasted in the dud, and then you cut to reaction shot of whoever was looking on having the slow spreading smile. Man, I just, fills me with giddy glee.
Yeah,
I laugh like a moron for 20 minutes at it, and I don't know. It's just, I always liked it. Even just the plain vanilla version of it from the original episode makes me laugh. But these remixes for some reason are so absurd.
It's such a simple remix and it's the same thing every time, but I fall for it every time. And I really think we're in the middle of a sort of dud mania period on the internet. Yes. Like I see the dud everywhere. In fact, my good friend just got a tattoo of the dud. So he's cementing that in time.
Oh my God. I freaking love that. And I will tell you that all came from the mystery date game in my basement. Like, and my sister, my older sister always referred to people as a dud, or that was like the insult when I was a little kid, because they had that game in the basement, that exact game, the mystery date game. And so like the general insult in my house when I was about six was to call someone a dud. And so it was a huge treat for me to be able to dredge that out of my memory banks and force it into that episode, even though that's actually not what the dud looks like at all. The dud in the game is kind of like just kind of a dirty drifter type. And there's a nerd who actually looks a lot like Milhouse, who's like a winner. And so like, if you look at the original Mystery Date game from like the 50s or 60s, you'll see it's interesting how people's ideas of what an unfashionable man or boy is supposed to be have evolved. Thank you for listening to my speech.
No, I love that. Yeah. I think my favorite one I saw is from Homer the Smithers of Burns putting up the mirror to see if Homer is still out there. And then it reveals the dud. And then it's Homer's head smiling on Burns's body.
Yeah.
I'm laughing just thinking about it. Why does it always work?
It has some – the thing is, to me, it has some sort of strange – a lot of Simpsons shitposting, but almost that – that one in particular has some sort of strange vibe that it's like there's something about it that is otherworldly or uncanny. It seems to me it's kind of eerie in a way, especially the way that those things just happen slowly and there's no music or sound. It just it's a little creepy almost.
Yeah, kind of like a nightmare version.
Exactly.
So the last time we talked to you, you said when we asked for you to plug something, you said, well, in 6 months, I'll have something to talk about. And so I am assuming that was the recently announced Disenchantment, which is the new Matt Groening-led show coming to Netflix. And you're working on it. I believe Josh is the showrunner on it. And I'm just curious what you could tell us about it and how you came to be involved in it.
Well, I presumably came to be involved in it because of my long history with both Josh and Matt and that type of material. Josh had been – I can't go into too many details. Because
we understand.
Is, you know, the show is like – I've never been involved in the show with this level of secrecy on it. We've already been working for more than a year on the show, and it's been a total secret until like 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
The scripts have fake covers and all this stuff like you have to sign – non-disclosure. I won't get into the details because those are probably secret too. But it's like the secretest thing ever. And the show is called Disenchantment. It is a Matt Groening production. It has all this Matt Groening style art and stuff that you would come to love and expect from Simpsons and Futurama. A lot of people from those shows and a lot of animators from those shows. The show, Josh is the showrunner, correct? He developed it. He developed the show with Matt. And I guess I'm co-executive producer. I'm kind of serving as a co-head writer with Josh, but I am not there every day because I live in Portland. So the vast majority of my work is done on Skype or is me reading scripts, rewriting scripts and so forth. And there's a number of people from Futurama. David X. Cohen is consulting on the show.
Oh.
And there's a whole bunch of other people from the, you know, other Matt Groening things as well. So it is, I believe it's going to be the kind of thing that everyone has obviously a totally new take with a whole set of new characters, but a new world filled with the kind of humor and animation and satire that we've all come to know and love from Matt. That's probably all I can say about that. But it's a great show. We're all having a great time working on it. I'm sure that you've seen from the press release, there's a number of great actors from Futurama as well who are on it, as well as a whole new cast of kind of a new generation of comedians and voice actors too that are the stars of the show. I don't know. I can answer a few more questions, but I can't tell you anything about the show.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean it was super exciting news. I feel like it was over a year ago that the announcement that Matt Groening was working on a Netflix show, but that was really all we knew. That obviously was enough to excite a Simpsons fan, but to then once Disenchantment was finally officially revealed and just seeing all the veterans of Simpsons and Futurama, especially like some of my favorite years of The Simpsons, it was even more exciting. And so, yeah, I think, okay, so what's it like, you know, working on this show with this level of involvement, you know, remotely and not being in LA for it? Like, is that different, I would guess?
It is and isn't. Like this, with what I'm doing right now, certainly wouldn't have been possible even 10 years ago, because I am in the room. We don't necessarily have the room every day because a lot of the writing is done, you know, at home by people working on scripts and stuff. But when we do have the room, I am often in it. I have a hardwired Skype connection to the room, and it's basically just like it's about 80% as good as actually being there. So it's kind of it certainly couldn't have been done even like 7 years ago, just technically. But and I do fly down for the reads and for other things. It's actually not that different, strangely, than. It's also not a show that is in all room all day. Like The Simpsons was all room all day long. This is a show that is there's a lot of room, but there's also a lot of individual writing as well, which then goes to the room, of course. But partially because the show is just starting up, we're not yet dealing with the avalanche of material that you would have on a show that was already going. Like because we don't have color episodes coming back from Korea while we're writing new ones and stuff. We're still on the ramping up phase.
I see. And, you know, you mentioned Futurama. Like, what was your and Josh's involvement in Futurama? You're not really, I don't believe you're on any of the commentaries, but I would see your guys' names in the credits. I was just always curious what you guys did on Futurama.
We consulted, basically, which is kind of, I mean, probably in the same vein that Dave is doing now on This Enchantment. Like, we were basically there for two or three days a week, just during that one season. But now, Josh worked on Futurama a lot more than I did. Like I was working on Portlandia at that time and living in Portland, and he was on Futurama during the Comedy Central season. So that would be a question for him. When we were there, it was just purely like we would be in the room to help out for 2 or 3 days a week. And, you know, I wouldn't say that we contributed anything really substantial other than just like a lot of funny jokes, hopefully. And we definitely helped work out the story of that Roswell episode significantly. But it wasn't like, you know, we didn't write any scripts or anything.
Okay. And yeah, I had gotten the feeling, you know, in the transition from 8 to 9, that a number of the folks from season 8 kind of went over to Futurama. Was that the case? Was it a lot of like bleed over of the season 7 and 8 staff into Futurama?
I can't think of who you mean other than Dave Cohen. I mean,
Ken Keeler. And Patrick Verone.
Oh, yeah.
And,
Verone was not on The Simpsons.
Oh, he was. Oh, okay. Oh no, he wrote a 2005 episode. All right, never mind.
Yeah, I think that there was probably a 2-year gap though. Like season 9, I think David Cohen was there for season 9 and season 10. I think. And that was around the time Futurama was starting up, yeah.
So I guess we're out of time now, Bill, but thank you so much for giving us more of your time, and hopefully we can talk again. This has all been great, and I'm sure we'll immediately think of 19 questions we should have asked you as soon as we're done here.
Hey, well, you know where to reach me. I got this Skype connection on that I'm not using right now, so
any time of the day.
Dial me up anytime, I know, and I'm always happy to chat about old stuff rather than have to sit here and do the arduous work of making up new stuff. So
we will be back to distract you.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I forgot one last question I wanted to ask you. Sorry. This was a back and forth we'd had on Twitter I'm sure you don't remember, but that about Rick and Morty getting the sauce they had written into the show, and how, are you a little jealous that these days brands are much more plugged in to send in free stuff to a show that's cool back when The Simpsons was cool, people weren't really doing that.
You guys, you have another hour? It's going to take me an hour to answer this question.
Oh,
the
no.
Answer is yes. Yes, 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 yes. And it was one of the things that continually made me mad back in the old days and still makes me a little mad is that, yes, because I'm just going to – this is the simplified version of it. No grown-ups were watching The Simpsons back then, or if they were – they certainly were not in positions to send us a lot of free stuff because, like, for instance, we had friends who worked on Seinfeld. And any time that Seinfeld mentioned anything, they get like a free truckload of it. And like it happened. And believe me, they mentioned a lot of stuff and they'd always get stuff. And we never got anything. The only thing during the time that we were there, you recall in the first clip show, there was a mention of Stridex pads.
Right.
And the guy said, I'm in Pizza Face Paradise. So then this free box of Stridex pads showed up and it said, thank you for making Stridex the pad of choice in Pizza Face Paradise.
That's cute.
And that was the only thing we ever got, except for a box of different flavored schnapps from Marty Ingalls. After Krusty said,
all right.
After Krusty Remember Krusty said that Shirley Jones and Marty Ingalls had the best New Year's parties?
Yeah.
Marty Ingalls sent us a box of Schnapps of assorted flavors, and he said he was, you know, he was grateful for the mention, and he was thrilled, and I thought that was a super classy thing of him to do. I think we tried to have him on at a certain point after that. Anyway, that was the only thing we ever got, and we never got anything from any of those places. For instance, Chicken Tonight. Not that I really liked Chicken Tonight or wanted it, but we sure did mention them, and it was mainly for a sake of kind of mocking them, but come on.
You deserve free Chicken Tonight.
Yeah, that's the end. I'm not going to go into any more detail about that, but suffice it to say that, yes, it always ground my gears that The Simpsons was unable to ever get any free stuff. Thank you.
Cool. Well, we'll let you get back to work, Bill. What is your Twitter address for everybody out there who wants to tweet at you?
It is That Bill Oakley, and that is OAKLEY. That Bill Oakley. You can find me on Twitter at all hours of the day when I'm supposed to be working. I'm often on Twitter, so you feel free to reach me.
Awesome. Thanks again.
All right, guys. It has been a huge pleasure. I look forward to coming back in the future.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Bill. So yes, that was our interview. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly had an awesome time doing it, and I was not nervous at all. Now Bill Oakley's just some guy. The magic is gone. I'm kidding.
No. I got to relax a bit more talking with Bill as well, and I'm starting to feel comfortable calling him Bill. I still think in emails I'm going to call him Mr. Oakley.
You got to you open with Bill, Henry. You have to at this point. We're all best friends now. Yes, we're going to go on camping trips and stuff.
But again, thank you very much, Mr. Oakley. I did it.
You did it again.
Thank you very much, Bill, for his time. And yeah, I can't wait to talk with him more. And also, like, him and Reed Harrison, like, there's so many Simpsons writers out there. And like you said, after the Reed Harrison interview, I want to talk to them all.
Yeah, I feel confident in talking to every Simpsons writer. And I would ask every one of you listening out there in Patreon land, go to Twitter at That Bill Oakley and tell him thank you for being on the show. He said he got an enormous amount of feedback from being on Talking Simpsons, and we want to let him know he's a welcome part of our little stable here.
Hell yeah. Yeah, and again, thank you to all you patrons who made this possible. Bob and I are doing this at a work day when we would have, like last time we did a Bill Oakley interview, we had to call in sick.
You guys.
Yeah, to do it. But this time we were able to just do it in the middle of the day because this is our job.
Yes, and I'm enjoying it so much, and I hope you're enjoying all the extra stuff we're putting out on Patreon.
Infotainment.